City FM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BC FM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BC FM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Polonium, Paraguay and the Straits of Hormuz feature in our weekly roundup of world events. And after his insight a few weeks ago into who owns Britain, author of the book of the same name and Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Carhill spreads his wings a little further as we ask the question in the title of his more recent book, Who Owns the World? And we take a look at the massive farm subsidies to the already rich and powerful landowners, as David Powell from Friends of the Earth is here to talk about land grabbing, commodities, population, and to look at China. But first, a little tour around world affairs. Martin Summers, we had two, since we last spoke, conferences all about Syria. One at the United Nations in Geneva, and now one today going on in Paris.
Well, yes, I mean, the situation there is very grave, very serious. The possibility of a major war growing out of it is growing day by day. I understand the Turkish army have been mobilised, that there are US troops in Jordan, there's a Russian aircraft carrier in place, and fighting continues. Although, as we pointed out the other week, there's considerable dispute about the Hula massacre, with the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung quoting Catholic sources in Damascus saying that in actual fact the massacre was carried out by the rebels and was actually of regime supporters, but it was being used by the Western powers as an example of the beastliness of the regime. And what's going on in Syria is clearly very, very murky, but very, very nasty. And even the Western powers admit that there are car bombs and other things being carried out by the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is not made up of peaceful demonstrators.
Well, we also had the Channel 4 News correspondent Alex Thompson, didn't we, who was alleging that the Free Syrian Army actually sent him into an ambush because...
They wanted him killed so that it would make the regime look bad.
Yeah, so what about the outcomes of these talks? And also, of course, this thing a couple of weeks ago, which was the shooting down of a Phantom reconnaissance aircraft, a Turkish NATO aircraft jet by the Syrians. This is getting quite tense, isn't
it? It's brinkmanship, isn't it? I mean, the possibility, you see, is that this war could spread quickly into Lebanon. And, of course, there were 44 people killed outside of Shia Mosque in Iraq this week. I mean, basically, the potential for the whole Middle East to just turn into a huge charnel house is definitely there. And the West's approach to this, which is to be completely belligerent and to encourage the Free Syrian Army not to negotiate, whereas Assad had his election in which 60% of the population participated. Now, like him or loathe him, there is, in fact, he can't pretend that he has no popular support, especially amongst the minorities, non-Sunni minorities within Syria. And the democratically elected government of Lebanon and the democratically elected government of Iraq are both supporting
Assad.
Well,
he may have popular support, right, but there are lots of people in his country who feel the need to rise up against him, uprising.
I wouldn't like to... if I was a Syrian, I wouldn't know which side you'd be on. It would depend upon your family loyalties, it would depend upon what beastly experiences you'd had with whoever. But the point is, what the Russians are pushing for is, let's have a political solution. Let's get everybody who's got an interest in this to sit down and come up with some kind of proposal.
Yes, but the Hillary Clinton point of view is that there isn't going to be a political solution.
Well,
it doesn't look like...
The only thing that they will accept is for Assad to go, and basically he's not going to go, but that what will happen is it will carry on escalating and possibly turn into a regional war.
What about these exercises that the Syrians are carrying out at the moment, apparently simulating an attack on a Western airbase? They're also now absolutely passed the legislation.
That was the Iranians.
And they've passed legislation in their parliament to close the Straits of Hormuz, and also they have made it quite clear they've developed all the sorts of anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles missiles, and they've been practicing with these missiles, ready to really take out much of the Western fleet that's around that area.
Yeah, well, I think the idea that the Iranians are going to be a pushover is ludicrous. They are actually pretty competent, and they will make, if it comes to fighting, they will equip themselves in a very competent fashion, I imagine. But the danger here is that we're going to end up with a general Middle East war as the banks go down, and it's going to be pretty horrendous for people all over the world if that's what happens.
Well, one of the reasons for all this, of course, is that the EU has just subtracted 18% of Iran's exports of crude oil, whilst also withdrawing maritime insurance coverage for her tanker fleet. So, I mean, that's really basically economic warfare, isn't it? It's cutting
it
out.
It's also economic warfare by the EU against itself, because by making who uses Iranian oil? Oh, it's Greece, Spain and Italy.
Ah, but the US, Martin, has indicated it will release oil from its strategic reserves to compensate for any price rises.
Well, I mean, this is all pretty silly. I mean, we ought to be focusing on trying to solve the financial crisis, not starting a war in the Middle East. There is no reason whatsoever for there to be a war with Iran. But we're going to get one anyway, because certain powerful forces are determined that we're going to have one.
Fearful of an Israeli air attack on its nuclear weapons program, although this is the Daily Mail speaking here, I'm not sure that Iran actually does have a nuclear weapons program. General Amir Ali Hazajeh, I mean, surely that should say it's nuclear power program, shouldn't it? But anyway, this is the Daily Mail creeping in a nuclear weapons program.
Leon Panetta, who's a US Defense Secretary, has admitted that there is no evidence whatsoever for them having a nuclear program. But there's a kind of... nuclear weapons program. There's cognitive dissonance goes on. So on one side of their mouths, they're saying, yes, well, there is no evidence. And then they say, yes, but we've got to stop them having this program. But there isn't a program. Now, what's going on here, frankly, is this is the kind of bullying tactics that were adopted by Hitler in the run-up to World War II.
But, I mean, if you were the Iranian president, wouldn't you want nuclear weapons? You're being surrounded by
logical
US bases.
It would be logical, but the position of the Iranians is that, you know, we don't want nuclear weapons. Although, as we know, the number of South Africa's nuclear weapons are floating around out there, because they were sold, we have inside information about this, because they were bought on the black market by leading British conservatives for profit, and then they lost them. Now, there's at least three of those warheads, and possibly six or eight others that were dropped in the sea off Somalia.
Now, have you actually got any evidence for that?
We've got... I can't tell you the name of the source, but it's somebody who's very, very close to what's happened and knows a lot about it.
Well, if people are interested in that information, say, for example...
They need to look in Veterans Today, which is a US publication. Look at Gordon Duff's articles in there. He's an ex-US Marine. He's covered the story.
Okay, and at the same time as this ramping up of tension around the Straits of Hormuz, etc., how real do you think that is? Is this just saber rattling? A Phantom plane is shot down. That's an old plane. They're from the 1970s. Mm.
Yes, which is why, you know.
Is it just saber rattling?
Which is why it looks like a provocation. Well, frankly, the problem we've got now is that any spark could set it off. Yeah, just a miscalculation by somebody, and we'll all be in a major war.
And at the same time, we hear this week that Britain's army is being slashed to its smallest size since the Napoleonic Wars. Shadow Defence Secretary Jim Murphy, though, stressed that the Argyll and Southern Highlanders were being reduced to guarding castles and being the backdrop to Japanese tourists' photographs under these reforms. Five infantry battalions are being axed as fighting forces, and four armoured units will merge into two, and 10 more major units are to go.
Well, I mean, I think we've got to actually start thinking about what sort of armed forces we would want for the kind of, you know, future that we want for ourselves. I would see the British Army basically being as a peacekeeping force, which means that you wouldn't need infantry, we perhaps don't need aircraft carriers, and probably don't need nuclear submarines. But in any case, the fact of the matter is that there are reports that, you know, British mercenaries are operating inside Syria already, and in actual fact, the war's already started.
Okay, now what about the links between Syria and Iran? Because we're seeing a lot of terrible situation actually ongoing now in Syria. But to what extent is that related to the tension with the Iranian regime?
It is linked, because the Assad regime, which is an Alawite, he's an Alawite, which is a kind of Shia, they are aligned with Iran. And Iraq and Lebanon, of course. People forget that Syria has allies. It's not just isolated.
And
the potential is for two coalitions are emerging now in global politics. One is the NATO-led coalition, which is North Atlantic Treaty Organization fighting in the Hindu Kush. And we've got the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the Chinese, the Russians and their chums. And these are the two sides for World War III. That's where we're possibly going.
Okay, what about this meeting today, though, in Paris? Because the Chinese and the Russians are not there. Obviously, the Syrians are not there, and the Iranians are not there. So is there really any point in having a meeting where it's only one side?
It's a war planning meeting by the Western powers. They've excluded everybody else. They don't want to be there, and they're planning to intervene. They're already intervening in Syria, but they're planning to intervene more.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, tomorrow it's the 7th of July 2012. That is exactly 7 years after the 7th of July 2005 attacks on London. Martin Summers, the significance of that, we spoke to Ben Fellows, who's now been outed. That was his cover name was Lee Hazeldine at the London Olympics, about the potential for a terror attack at the London Olympics being quite open. What do you think, if you were advising the G4S and the police over London, what would you point them to about lessons to be learned from the 7/7 attacks this year?
Well, the problem is a key issue here is the privatisation of public security. So, as you know, Tony, the CCTV system on the London Underground is not run by London Transport Police or by London Transport. It's actually run by a private security firm, Veritas Systems, with head office in Tel Aviv.
It's Verint. V-E-R-I-N-T. Verint.
Verint Systems. What did I say? I can't remember anyway. But the point is that this actually exposes your infrastructure to attack. ICTS is again a private Israeli security company. They're in charge of security at Schiphol Airport, where the so-called underpants bomber was taken onto the plane. We've got eyewitnesses, top lawyers who are watching what happened. He was taken onto the plane with no passport, no security check, no ticket. I suspect that what you need to think about in terms of terrorism is internal terrorism orchestrated from within by elements within the security forces. I'll put it no stronger than that. We've got a long track record of Western intelligence services engaging in these kind of provocations, from bombing of Bologna, the Brabant massacres in the 1980s in Belgium, the Dortmund beer hall massacre. I mean, this has all been investigated by parliamentary inquiries in both Belgium and Italy. It's quite clear what was going on. Security services were the terrorists.
Well, when it comes to the 7th of July 2005 attacks, there has been no public inquiry. All there has been effectively is a coroner's inquest into the deaths, which hasn't really looked at some of the wider pictures. It's just looked at the forensic, what actually happened to those specific individuals, and not really the sort of train of evidence that goes away from those bombs. And one of the fascinating facts of it all was Peter Power, this guy from Visor Consultants, who popped up on the TV, and we've done a bit of an investigation into that, and eventually Peter Power has admitted that this spooky coincidence exercise that he was doing on the same day as the attacks at the same three tube stations was actually being carried out for Reed Elsevier, who are big publishers. But the thing is, Reed Elsevier are also people who organise conferences, and one of the conferences they organise is the biggest arms fair in the world, the Docklands Arms Fair. Doesn't this also suggest that possibly there are private interests involved sometimes in these terror attacks? And doesn't compromise people like Peter Power, who's a former police officer?
Well, I mean, what we know from past history is that when you've got exercises going on, these exercises can sometimes be flipped to be live exercises. And the other thing, the first thing I noticed about 7/7, as you'll remember, Tony, because you were flying back from Hungary, was that Benjamin Netanyahu did not go to a meeting he was supposed to go to that morning at Liverpool Street, near Liverpool Street Station. So the Jerusalem Post phoned up the Israeli embassy and said, there's been a bomb attack in London, is BB all right? And they said, yes, he's fine, we had a warning, and he didn't go to his meeting. And, of course, that then raises questions, doesn't it? How does Benjamin Netanyahu get a warning of a no-warning terror attack?
Well, to be fair,
London tube stations.
To be fair, Brian Paddick actually denied that at the time. So let's go back to the 7th of July 2005 and have a listen to that press conference.
Charles Crichton, Sunday Herald for DAC, Paddock. Could you clear up this question of a warning? AP are quoting an official from the Israeli embassy in London saying that they received a warning from Scotland Yard a couple of minutes before an explosion. And as a result, some of their government officials didn't go to a conference in London. Was there no warning or no intelligence at all?
The information I have at the moment is that there were no warnings given to the police at all.
And any intelligence? That something might happen today?
But the information I have at the moment is that there were no intelligence in our possession that these attacks were going to take place today, and we have we were given no warning by any organisation that this was going to happen.
So there's Brian Paddock saying there was no warning, but the Associated Press spoke to somebody at the Israeli embassy that said that that Scotland Yard actually warned the Israeli embassy, and that Benjamin Netanyahu never left his hotel that morning, which if he had have left it, he may have actually been caught up in one of the bombings.
Well, I suspect that Benjamin Netanyahu was tapped on the shoulder by the Mossad agents in the Israeli embassy. And if I was in charge of the investigation into 7/7, I would have surrounded the Israeli embassy, cut off the water, cut off the electricity, refused to let anybody go until they explained to me where they got that warning from.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it was 6 weeks ago since he was last here. Kevin Carhill's caused me to nearly fall off my chair when he pointed out that the Bristol City has 20,000 homeless people, but we are living in an unprecedented era of property ownership here in the UK. Now, I wonder, Kevin, could we pick up where we left off last time on that very point? Is that actually true? Welcome to Drive Time this evening.
Yeah, no, the if you like, the bald statistics say that about 65% of the population own, you know, as family groups, own a private dwelling.
And that's the largest amount ever, is that right?
Ever. In 1872, the last time for which there are reliable statistics, it was less than 4%. Okay. That's the big transformation that no one's paid attention
to. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I was going to say, well, why don't any political parties focus on what I suppose are effectively small landowners now, aren't they? A little bit like the sort of small farmers from many, many years ago, or peasant farmers or whatever. Effectively, these homeowners are small landowners, aren't they?
Yeah. But can you imagine? Those small landowners are very large in number, 65% of the population. Suppose they all focused on their key interest, the protection of their home. You could find a single political party emerging on that interest alone. What the establishment need at the moment is what we've got, three different parties, none of them with a proper policy, and dividing the potential homeowner, vote.
Now, you say 65%, but surely not all of those have finished paying off their mortgage, have they?
No, it varies. About the number who have finished paying off their mortgage is around about 21%.
So that leaves, what, 44% haven't. So yeah. The majority of homeowners are still, to a certain extent, in hock to the banks.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, what sort of policies do you think, would appeal to those sorts of people, and what would you like to see our political parties? I mean, in a way, especially with the financial situation, there is a certain amount of ferment going on in politics, and it may be that some new ideas might come through.
This might be the time, but there are three political parties will be petrified of homeowners, if you like, getting together and focusing on what their interest is, protecting their homes from banks, from irresponsible politicians. Earlier on, you mentioned an election in Iceland where Ólafur Grímsson, who is an acquaintance of mine, has been re-elected for the fifth time. And, if you like, Ólafur's influence led to the charging and conviction of the Icelandic Prime Minister during the boom and bust. And to the, I don't know whether they've been convicted, but 100 bankers and financial officials have been charged or are being investigated. That's what we need here.
Well, I think that's what they did in Iceland, as I understand it, is they looked at the one, they interviewed lots of them, they also got many of them to give information about others, and they found at least who they believed were the sort of ringleaders, yeah. And that they gave many of them fines, and the ringleaders that they actually put in jail in Iceland.
Yeah. Well, do you have any confidence that the Tory chair of a parliamentary investigation is going to name a couple of thousand bankers who should be named, doing illegal acts?
Well, I think
so it's not going to happen. And is any parliamentarian going to say that Gordon Brown and Tony Blair were negligent? Because if you follow the Icelandic example, Tony Blair should be in the dock, charged with negligence.
Okay, so what would you suggest, though, as policies going forward, appealing, I suppose, to what we've started calling these small landowners, the homeowners of Britain?
Yeah. Well, the first policy should be, if you are working and you're paying tax, you should be insured for your mortgage payments. That's absolutely vital. You're paying your taxes. There should be no further debate about it. Taking your home away from you because you lose your job quite frequently because of government mismanagement is ridiculous. It's ridiculous economically. It's ridiculous socially. You know, throwing families out on the street.
But aren't people's homes used as a way to sort of persuade them to knuckle down in society? You know, the threat of actually losing your home is an effective way, isn't it, of getting people to, you know, go to work, get out of bed in the morning and go to work, and you know, and earn as much as they can to give them that security that their home will be there.
But can you think of any more potent argument for ensuring that those who do work, pay their taxes, are insured? That would deal with that fear. Remember, Thatcher ruled by fear. She didn't rule by consent. She didn't rule by being nice. She threatened people, you know, behave or else. And you've just articulated it. So there should be an absolute guarantee that if you work and pay your taxes, end of story, and you lose your job.
Well, I agree with that. I've just been indicating that I should say something. Well, I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Martin, what are your thoughts, though, on this whole... I mean, the principle we're talking about here is that we don't know how lucky we are today. We've got 65% of people out there are actually landowners now for the first time in British history. Yeah. This is something that for years and years and years ago... I mean, if you go back to medieval times, people were all supposedly, anyway, serfs to the local lord of the manor. Now, people have their own little patch. It may not be enough to grow enough food to live on for a year, but it's certainly a secure home.
Well, yes, one of the problems you've got, though, with the British economy is this boom-bust property cycle that comes along every you know, decade or so. They used to call it stop-go, but in actual fact it's go-stop. So what happens is the economy starts to pick up, you start to export, things start to move along, and then house prices start to rise in the southeast of England. So then interest rates have to rise to cap the rise in house prices, and then that means that just as Blackpool or Yorkshire is just about getting going, the brakes have to go on. And in actual fact, it's been this property-owning democracy, as it were, without the underpinning of a proper council-owned sector or social sector, just leads to a kind of... It's like a huge flywheel which completely derails the economy once every decade or so. And nobody else in Europe does it like that. They look at it and go, why are you doing it like that? And, of course, you've got vested interests, what I call the inflationist bloc in the southeast of England, because they make money on this whole process as it goes through.
But I think, you know, a stable banking system would help. But no, a lot of places in Europe tried to pick up our example. Spain did. The Irish Republic had 82% home ownership. I mean, to me, the ideal is 100%. But absolutely, you must have a council sector, you know, for people who need and who don't want to own homes. It's a reasonable choice. But The basics are really simple. There's no such thing as perfection in life, but the best form of security you're going to get for your family, the most important thing to most of the population, is your own property in your own hands, even if it has cost you a lot of money. In the case of recent times, far too much through the mortgage payments. But that is the best security that has been designed or arrived at so far in terms of giving families secure shelter. Go take it down to real basics. You know, you have to have shelter, even almost before you have to have food. But it's fundamental, it's a human right. And so far, the best form of that right, the most reliable, is owning your own home.
Okay, a couple of things, Kevin. First of all, have we ever had a system where people are actually guaranteed a home?
No, I mean, historic. I mean, you've said it several times. This is the transformation in our country that no economist has looked at. It's just been kind of ignored. But can you see the political reasons for ignoring it? The last thing the politicians want is a single issue constituency that they have to address, which would force them to address manipulation of interest rates, repossession tactics by bailiffs that are out of the bloody Middle Ages, and so on. The last thing the three political parties want is homeowners to kind of form a group and say, We're now the single biggest group in our country. We have a basic issue here that is actually a basic human right, the right to a secure shelter. Now, you people, fix that. No more boom and bust, stop, go.
Okay,
no
but we're in a situation now where on the Bristol City Council's wonderful all singing, all dancing housing website, which is called Choice Based Lettings, there are 15,000 people looking for somewhere to live in this city. The unofficial figures, there's another 5,000 that have either given up with the system or it for one reason or another, sometimes because they just don't have the faculties to deal with this computer system. There's another 5,000 on top of that, so we've got 20,000 people we know homeless in the city right now. How do we get from that situation to, you know, your perfect world and my perfect world, which is where everybody has got somewhere to live and that they're not under threat of eviction?
Secure shelter. Now, who benefits? Go back to what a detective should ask when he's investigating a crime. Who benefits? Cui bono? It's a good way to look at an investigation. Now, about a week and a half ago, there was a totally straight news report on the BBC about how much of the United Kingdom is under bricks and mortar. It's actually 6.8%. Now, in my book, I prevaricated over this. On the justifiable grounds, I couldn't get reliable statistics, but the figure looked like 6.8%. And the poor reporter who did the report was blasted out of the water for propaganda, for anti-environmentalists and all this sort of rubbish, because of course if only 6.8% of the country is under bricks and mortar, there's an awful lot of it available for building houses. So build more houses.
Well, you could say that, but then of course you need to also preserve the beauty of the countryside. One of the things that people don't necessarily realise, for example, if you're going on the train or driving through Wiltshire, you can go for miles and miles and there's not a single house. This is all being depopulated. Can you just give us a little bit of an idea of the history? Because certainly if you go back 300, 400, 500 years, you would have found lots of little cottages around that they're simply not there anymore.
Well, if, say, you have a village and some outsiders buy second homes, the logical thing to do, which nobody seems to have done, is build a few more houses at the edge of the village and replace the ones, because second home ownership is not a proven dangerous thing, you know, a bad thing. But go back to a very brief story. You've heard of the Council for the Protection of Rural England. Well, nobody knows who funds them. But a couple of years ago, they produced a story that if we went on at the present rate, we would have bricked over England by 2030. They were only wrong by 2041 years, and none of the media checked it. Even if we went on building at the current rate of industrial and domestic buildings, that's when we would brick over England in 2400 years' time.
But surely, rather than bricking over the countryside, we should be bricking over or building on top of some of these old industrial estates. This is one of the things that, if you go around this city, you will find loads of sites which have just been left flattened and left.
Yep.
There, you could if you're going to start building, surely that's the place to start.
But you're accidentally contributing to the landowner's argument, which is how we have wound up with an inadequate housing supply and the smallest homes in Europe. If 6.8% of the current country is covered with bricks and mortar, that means 94% of it isn't. There's a little more room in the countryside than people think, and people have been led to believe the countryside is threatened. It could be threatened by indiscriminate building, but by carefully planned building using real facts instead of the propaganda of the Council for the Protection of Rural England and others.
Well, I mean, they're basically a pressure group protecting the interests of people who've bought nice properties in the country and don't want to have their view spoiled.
No, they're actually protecting a deeper interest, because that's not where their funds are coming from. Their funds are coming from large landowners, mostly.
Well, maybe some of those landowner funds are coming via the Common Agricultural Policy subsidies, because I've got a list here of the huge annual cap payments and other financial aid which went out in the financial year 2010 to 2011. I'll just run through a few, and if you want, stop me, Kevin, and you can comment on some of these. Tell us who these landowners are. The Duke of Buccleuch got £550,000. The Duke of Westminster got £532,000. Lord Carrington is a former Foreign Secretary. Got £150,000. Richard Drax MP, nearly £418,000. Prince Charles, £581,000. The Queen, she was paid over £500,000 a year in cap subsidy for privately owned Sandringham. Well, that's a little bit of that might have gone to towards CPRE as a donation. And over the decade of the noughties, Tate and Lyle, the sugar company, and they do all sorts of other things too, but they received a cap subsidy of €830 million. Yes. 700 UK recipients got more than £250,000, 133 got at least £500,000, and 47 individuals got more than £1 million in cap subsidy.
Okay, go down the list and I'll tell you what each of them is worth.
The Duke of Buccleuch, to start with,
is worth about £2 billion.
He doesn't really need that.
Go to the next one.
The Duke of Westminster,
£7 billion.
Lord Carrington,
don't know. Okay. He's not on the rich list.
Prince Charles,
about £750 million, or £1 billion if you correctly assess the value of the Duchy of Cornwall. So he's a billionaire.
So these people don't really need these payments, nope. Do they? The Queen,
right? It's finally happened. The Queen's valuation in the Sunday Times rich list was reduced because, quite fairly, of uncertainties about the Crown estate. The recent switch in legislation has indicated clearly that she owns it. So the Queen is worth what she was in the original seven issues of the Rich List. She's worth £7 billion.
But so why does she need £500,000 a year as a cap payment?
None of these people need this money. It's the poor, the rest of us, giving to the rich because of a misstructured system.
Right, well, we'll be talking to Kevin Carroll a bit more after some music. And this is from Tennessee Ernie Ford, the song being 16 Tons.
'Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron,
the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Tennessee Ernie Ford there from sometime during the 1950s, and 16 tons. And I'm joined by Kevin Carhill, who's the author of Who Owns Britain and also author of Who Owns the World. Can you just tell us what took you from the Who Owns Britain thing to Who Owns the World? Because it might sound obvious, but were there particular landowners in Britain that made you think, well, I need to look a little bit wider?
Well, the largest landowner on earth lives in Britain, and that's the Queen. She is the legal owner of a sixth of the planet.
A sixth of the planet?
Yep.
The legal owner. Now,
yep.
Okay, so whereabouts does she own then?
Okay, she owns Canada, Australia.
I mean, you're talking about the entire country?
Yeah, the entire landmass is legally hers.
Well, what about all those people in Canada with freehold houses that have bought their homes? Yep. I mean, they are surely the legal owner, not the Queen.
No, it's like ourselves. Freehold is not ownership. It's a lease. It's a medieval form of leasehold.
If you say it, you're saying you're freehold, hold from somebody. Or
exactly.
Yeah.
You're so holding it from the crown.
Okay, so how has she managed to wangle that? Because why should anyone pay for a piece of land if actually the Queen, it's the Queen's, and she can have it any time she wants?
That's theoretical. I don't think that could happen in the modern age. But in Canada, it's much more rigorous than here and much more formally stated. Everywhere, you know, when you're trying to get a bit of forest, you found yourself up against the Crown's ownership at the door. Here in Britain, it's all been elided away. Every solicitor knows that freehold isn't ownership, and every solicitor in Britain knows that the ground under your feet belongs to the Crown. They just tell nobody.
So how does the Queen come to own all this? Is it sort of she is God's representative on Earth or something?
No,
what is it?
She's inherited the empire. That never went away. It just changed itself.
I mean, it does make Britain sound much more like a feudal system. It almost seems to me as if the Civil War never happened.
Yeah, it is a feudal system. You know, the idea of one owner and everybody else holding the land from that owner is the feudal principle. That's the underpinning of all feudalism.
So is there a sort of feudal superstructure in the background in today's modern society?
Yeah.
Or is it just the Queen?
No, there's lots of other states. We're not alone at all. China is effectively a feudal state. The state owns all land and everybody gets whatever lease they get from the state. Russia's different. There are only two constitutions on earth out of the 197 I read which formally say citizens may own land. One is the Russian one and the other one is somewhere in South America. But there are only two. Every other constitution uses legal prevarication over the distinction between property, which might include land but might not, and land itself, which most constitutions seem not to want to give to the citizens.
Well, I noticed from the blurb from your Who Owns the World book about the Queen that she owns a total of 6,600 million acres. Yeah, that's 6.6 billion acres. But, I mean, if much of that is not, you know, even though she's got legal title to it, it would be actually very difficult for her to actually do anything with that land. What's the point of the figure if it's not really a practical figure?
No, what's the point of any ruler at any time in history claiming the ownership of just England? What's the point? There was no way William the Conqueror could go around the counties, you know, saying, da, do. Once that claim is made, the Crown gets the right to decide who gets the lower tenancies and the rents. So 50 dukes pay the crown rent for, say, England as it was historically, and the dukes get the task of dealing with the peasants. It's a devolution of totalitarian power, if you like, but there's no way. But where it would become an issue was if Australia became a republic.
So would the Queen would then start getting maybe a little bit twitchy about all that land?
Yeah. But it plays out radically differently in Canada. In Canada, the only protection the Canadians have from invasion and occupation by the United States, which was US policy till the 1920s to annex Canada, is the fact they haven't got enough money to pay the bill. They would have to compensate the Queen, and they haven't got enough money.
The other thing you talk about in the book is you talk about the latest British Empire, the fourth or virtual empire. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
I mean precisely this, the Crown's ownership of a sixth of the planet.
But again, we come back to the fact that if the Queen doesn't actually have the power over that land, I mean, what power does she have?
She has the legal power.
If she's got a piece of paper, that doesn't mean anything.
No, but her governments, her governments, particularly in Canada, on her behalf, are pretty ruthless in saying, no, you can't have that, it belongs to the Crown. And if you want a bit of it, you pay the Crown's tenancies.
Now, I do remember a couple of years ago that the Queen intervened through the High Commission in Canada and actually suspended the government briefly. So there is obviously some, quite important powers that the Queen does have still. What about Ireland? I mean, you didn't mention that earlier on as an analogy. Look, why the landholding citizens of the Republic are serfs and not owners? I mean, is that true in Ireland too? Because, this is one of the things where it's almost a myth, that we think of Ireland as being one of the few places on earth where there's lots and lots of individual small landowners. Yeah. And it's almost like a dream for a lot of people to go to somewhere like that where you can just simply live out your existence with a small piece of land. And that's not really the case here in Britain at all. But is that true in Ireland?
When the Free State, which preceded the Republic, was created, the Crown's holdings were transferred to the state. And it's, again, the Constitution, both the Free State Constitution and the later Republican Constitution, hid it that the state had acquired the Crown's right over to all land. So Southern Ireland in particular, well, Northern Ireland's Crown property, but Southern Ireland, they're all just freeholders. The state owns the land. So the absolute ownership that most 95%, 99% of the population of the Republic thought that independence and freeholds meant they owned the land. The lawyers never told them, well, actually, that's not quite true.
But okay, again, I ask the same question. Practically, what's the difference? You know, because if the state actually just has a piece of paper saying they own the land, but they don't actually do anything with it, it may as well be your own property anyway.
No, go back to World War II. What happened? The state took over 11 million acres of the country. That's a sixth of the country, 60 million acres of the country, and no rent was paid. Now, other compensation for damages and things, but it's when emergencies occur that you see what this is all about. The Crown or the state can, on its own behalf, take over as much land as it wants, and that includes land from freeholders, because they can be told, sorry, we'll compensate you for the bricks but not for the site. And in World War II that happened a lot.
Okay, so if we go back really before the Industrial Revolution, this whole business of land enclosure, this is going back a little bit, further than we were talking about the Second World War. But if you go back far enough, you've got a rural-based economy. Everything's a lot simpler, surely. How was it? I mean, what I'm talking about is that there wasn't such a dependence on money. Nowadays, we're in the middle of a financial crisis right now. Yeah. We're all very, very dependent on our banks. Mm. But if you were to roll back a few hundred years, basically, you had access pretty much to the basics of life. You had somewhere to grow food, that kind of thing. We don't do that nowadays. We've got to go to a supermarket.
There was an acceptance. It wasn't as generous or kind as you think, but there was an acceptance that people were entitled to the basics, a shelter, food and water, all of which have now been monetized. But the enclosures really took away use rights. They weren't ownership rights. We make that distinction. But the use rights were granted by landowners based on a basic recognition that to live, people had to have certain things, shelter, water and food.
That's right. These use rights are things like the right to go and gather firewood,
yeah.
The right to go get mushrooms maybe from some field, the right to graze your sheep in a field, or this kind of thing. Is that what you mean?
That's what the enclosures were about. But the underpinning of the enclosures...
And it was a kind of privatisation of those rights, because they were then given to a specific individual. So it's not as if...
They were taken without compensation.
You know, we hear a lot about privatisation now, but that was quite a big privatisation. Mm. Can you just give us an idea of the years that it spread over? When did it happen?
It actually started in the 1600s on a small scale, and it peaked in the 1700s with... I can't remember the years, but one period, 8 million acres of just England. England's only 32 million acres in size, and 8 million acres was enclosed. And the total enclosures were probably, out of 32 million acres, there were over 20 million acres, two-thirds of the country, probably.
Well, now we're also joined by a very patient who's been sitting there for the last 5 minutes, David Powell from Friends of the Earth. Hi, David. You are the economics campaigner, a national campaigner for Friends of the Earth, are you?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Quite lucky to have you here in Bristol, aren't we?
Well, yeah, it's a great place to work, actually, and it made a lot of sense to shift over here.
So. So your thoughts then about what some of the stuff we've been hearing. I know that Friends of the Earth looks at land grabbing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, I think maybe we just start by asking you about the CPRE, because you must have quite a bit in common with CPRE. What do you know about how they're funded, that kind of thing?
I haven't got a clue how they're funded, Tony. I can tell you some areas where we have agreement with CPRE and some areas where we don't. I think we disagree with CPRE quite often about the siting of things like wind turbines and the siting of that sort of development in the countryside. I think we often find similar, I guess, to what Kevin was saying, we often find knee-jerk reaction to new proposals that we would like to see. I did have a question, actually, more for Kevin, about this 6.8% figure. So you were talking about only 6.8% of the UK is paved over with bricks and mortar, which sounds about right, but I guess that doesn't include parks and roads and things like that. Because I'll tell you why I'm asking, because I don't think it's just as straightforward as to present the sheer amount that's paved over and say that is, the if you like, the total amount of urbanisation, because wherever you have urban sprawl, you have more transport, you have more emissions, you have a greater infrastructure that spreads out. Yeah. It's a genuine question, but I would have thought you have to be careful about statistics.
You're wasting your time on that one. The roads won't change the figure much.
But what about...
0.5% maybe.
What about parks and facilities?
Well, no, parks are not bricked over areas.
Yeah, so that would be...
By definition.
So would you be advocating building on parks or...
No, don't ask that question. It's the wrong question. The right question is, how much land is there and how is it currently distributed? You know, how many houses are on it, where are they, etc.?
I would bring you back to this my point about Wiltshire. Yeah. You know, you can go through some counties and you can literally look across the whole horizon and see there's virtually no development whatsoever, which is nice, actually. But, you know, it doesn't mean to say that there can't be a few little cottages and whatever dotted around there.
Yeah,
okay, so land grabbing.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I really thought was interesting, you were talking about the fourth wave of colonialisation, that's a word I can't say on a Friday evening. I think there's another one going on, actually, which is what's happening with land grabbing around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a financialisation and a colonialisation that's happening.
Yeah.
If you look at what's happening with international pension funds, with sovereign wealth funds, where they're going into the poorest countries in the world, they're going into Africa, they're going into Asia, where, you know, the situation that we have
just
here...
Just like we did?
Well, absolutely. The fifth
What's
wave
the difference?
Well, the difference is that, for a start, this is the 21st century. I think people are very surprised to hear that still goes on. I mean, you were talking about how outrageous it is that no one really owns the land they live on. I mean, over in Africa and Asia, what's happening is people are being either marched off their land at gunpoint because pension funds want to invest in their land to build, to grow biofuels, or they're being promised jobs, which then don't materialise. Yeah. In some bits of sub-Saharan Africa, you know, there's only, never mind who actually owns the land, only 10% of people have actually got any claim at all on the land.
It's in the book.
And yeah,
do you know
yeah.
what the female claim on land is? About 2%.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's horrendous.
Shocking, yeah.
But we left the legacy of, if you like, empire in Asia and Africa, was that we left this feudal structure of land ownership, meaning corrupt governments in Africa can do what the crown could do here but probably couldn't. But corrupt in Zimbabwe, this principle was followed.
Yeah.
The land belongs to the state. Duh, you're out.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If we want to move 100,000 Chinese in, move on.
That's right. And I wouldn't just point the finger at corrupt governments. I'm sure you wouldn't just do that, because there is also major international finance behind this stuff as well. So you look at what's happened with the financial crash, with all of this money swilling around in the global financial system, needing somewhere to go, and increasingly it's going into land. People, you know, pension funds, yeah, sovereign wealth funds are buying up huge plots of land. I've got a figure here, 200 million hectares over the last decade, which is 100 times the size of Wales, pretty much, has been bought up,
yeah,
in Africa and Asia
again,
alone.
And why don't you start with the big figure? How much land is there? There's 36 billion acres. What's 400 million acres out of 36 billion?
Well, if you live on any of those 400 million acres, I mean, that's the point. I mean, what we're talking about here is... talking about the big picture isn't particularly helpful if you are on that.
No, I find it extremely unhelpful to start, if you like, without it. Giving the big picture.
Can I just intervene here?
Yeah,
because
sure.
There is a social aspect to this, and I think maybe what David's saying is that some of the weaker people living on the land who don't have whatever the legal resources, sometimes possibly even the military resources to resist takeover, those are the places where these land grabs are taking place. And they're taking place because many people with lots of wealth have simply got access to the money, but they want resources to buy with that money, because they can see the global financial situation the way it is. They want to invest in something tangible.
Yep. But as I say, I would find fault with anyone who starts with, well, it's 100 times the size of Wales. Most people actually don't understand what the size of Wales is, point one.
Well, it's pretty big,
if you tell them,
big, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And don't tell a Welshman that.
No, it's more honest to just say, there's this much land and there's that much that way. And don't make it complicated, you know, keep it...
Well, actually,
but
I
when you get down...
I think the opposite, because I think what you're trying to do is to always pull things up to the bigger picture, which risks... Actually, what I'm talking about is the impact that this has on people in their everyday lives. It's like me saying to you, you know, if I cut off your toe, oh, well, that's all right, because 95% of your body mass is still left. That doesn't actually...
No.
That's completely...
No. But the small argument is the one that fails to help these people who are having their land stolen.
Anyway, but
you know,
I think one of the things we all want, Kevin, is we all want a solution to this.
Yep.
So can you see that, you know, can you see anything sort of positive coming out of the financial crisis with regard to land ownership? Because, you know, we've got a situation where a lot of people like Friends of the Earth, I would imagine, David, are saying, well, hang on, this is actually quite good for global warming. It means that people won't be travelling so much. They won't necessarily have the money to spend on
recession.
Fuel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that there's a positive side to this. And can you see
it?
Can you see anything you know, similar with regards to the whole sort of land ownership question?
I think the question you should really ask is why that book has appeared out of the blue. I should, as the author, it's tricky, but when you're writing a book, at some stage when you start saying, where are the books before me? You know, where are the authors back in the 19th?
Well, this is one of the reasons I'd love to invite you in here, because I think there's very few people that do this. It's almost like, well, that's someone else's job, surely. That someone else's job syndrome, to write a book about who owns the world. And you've actually done it. So
this was the difference. As the author, I feel embarrassed to do it. But I was about a quarter way into the book and was hunting around for the previous books. You know, that would have been much easier to write in Imperial times, because, you know, you didn't have such... differentiation.
But anyway, David, I just want you to, before you finish, Kevin, tell us a little bit about what Friends of the Earth is up to at the moment and how people can get in touch.
Yeah, well, but specifically on this area, I mean, we're putting a lot of pressure on. I think really interesting what you said there, Kevin, about how hard this is to do. I mean, it's so hard for people to really understand what's going on. You know, everyone has a pension. You don't really know what your pension is doing, you know. And I do take your point that the world is a big place, but also I think people would be very surprised to learn, I think, £9 billion of UK pension holders' money is invested currently, is estimated, in what's called land grabbing. First thing to do, ask your pension fund, ask where it's going, ask what they're doing with the money, not just with land grabbing, but in general. And I think it's really interesting with all the stuff around Barclays and the banks at the moment, and everyone's starting to get a bit itchy about the whole system. Well, you know, not everyone's that bad. There are ethical pension funds.
There are ethical banks.
You do have the choice. And the more that people put pressure on them, the more you can start getting into the systemic stuff, opening it up.
Yeah,
and that starts to help people around the world. Really,
okay. What about your local meetings here? How can people go along and where can they find you?
Yeah, best thing to do, pop along to the web if you've got internet access. So www.foefriendsoftheearth.co.uk. On there, you'll find links to our Southwest pages. You'll find links to our Bristol group.
What about people who aren't necessarily internet friendly? Have you got a phone number?
Yeah, best thing to do, call our mainline number. It's 0207 490 155. Or failing that, pop along to our office. We're at number 10 Picton Street in Bristol.
Lovely, David, thank you. Kevin, just to round up, this whole business of people investing in land now and the financial crisis, have you got anything that you think we can say positive? It's lovely to hear that you sat down with the Icelandic president and had a bite with him. Is there any? You bought him supper. Gracious alive. What do you think? What do you think, in a nutshell, you'd say to something we can positively get out of this crisis?
The basic problem about land ownership and how land is grabbed is that there is an absence of legal protection for ordinary folks. That's historic. It's not going to be fixed overnight. The curious thing is some Chinese chap offered to buy some of Iceland, you know, a percentage, 0.5%, and Ólafur backed him from the big argument, what difference does 5%, 0.5%, yeah. But much more knowledge about rights, much more control over the pension funds so they don't behave unethically, and an absolute grip on the banks.
Okay, and your book, Who Owns the World and Who Owns Britain, am I right in thinking Who Owns Britain is out in a second edition as well this year?
It'll be back on the shelves this year.
Well, that's the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live in a minute with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, National Vice President of the Public and Commercial Services Union, or PCS, John McAnally. Also to David Powell, you just heard there, from Friends of the Earth, and also Kevin Carhill, author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World. And also, of course, to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, tax havens in the crosshairs, those places that all politicians want to close, but nobody ever seems to get round to doing anything about them. We have the tax justice campaign here. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times. Just go to www.thisweek.org.uk. Every BCFM show is available online at bcfm.org.uk. Some music from The Clash at the end of the show this week, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.